Chapter 9. I am tired, but must just jot down what has taken place today. At 8 a.m., we sighted a steamer of 3,000 tons, which we sunk, but I cannot say what she looked like, or whether anyone escaped, as we never came to the surface. Von Weissman sighting smoke on the western horizon, just as he hit her. We would steer in that direction, to the west. However, I think she went almost at once, as Von Weissman put a dot black on the chart as we made towards number 3. I very much wanted to know whether there were any survivors, but the captain was in a rage. The cause of his rage was as follows. Steamer number 3 turned out to be a fine fat chap of the clan line, Von Weissman said, when we first sighted her. We moved into attack and fired our port bow tube. I waited for the explosion, nothing happened, but after a couple of minutes a snarl came down the voice pipe. Surface, gun action stations. I ran aft, and found the captain white with rage. Mr. Head, he said with intense feeling, I'll have to use that confounded gun. In about 3 minutes the captain and myself were on the bridge, and the crew were at their stations round the gun. For the first time, I saw the ship. She was stern on and painted with black and white stripes. As I examined her through glasses, she was distant about 3,000 yards. I saw a flash aboard her, and a few seconds later a projectile moaned overhead, and fell about 6,000 yards over. So she is armed, thought I, unless he has actually opened fire on us first. The effect of this unexpected retort on the part of the Englishman was to throw Weissman into a paroxysm of rage. Why don't you fire? What the devil are you waiting for? I did not consider it advisable to mention to him that they were probably waiting his order to fire, and also his orders for range and deflection, as I had imagined that, here as everywhere else, an officer controls the gunfire. Apparently in this boat it is not so, as Weissman takes so little interest in his gun that he affects to be, or else actually is, ignorant of the elements of gun control. At any rate, under the lash of his tongue, the gun's crew soon got into action, the gun layer taking charge. Our first shot was short, very considerably so, as was also the second. Meanwhile the steamer had been keeping up a very creditably controlled rate of fire, straddling us twice, but missing for deflection, as was natural considering that we were bows on to her. I felt in my element the wail of the enemy's shell, punctuated by the ear-splitting report of our own gun. Weissman, gripping the rail with both hands, and ducking when one went overhead, made no attempt to control our gunfire, which was far from creditable. At the 10th or 11th round we hit her in the upper works, as was shown by a bright red and yellow flash near her funnel. This did not check her firing or speed in the least, she seemed to be gaining on us. She began to zigzag slightly and throw smoke bombs overboard. Matters were thus for some minutes. We had just hit her aft for the second time, though the shooting was bad, when there was a blinding flash, and the air seemed filled with moaning fragments. Two of the gun's crew were wounded, and one was lying, either killed or seriously wounded, on the casing. We had been hit in the casing, well forward, and, as was subsequently proved when we dived, little material damage was caused to the boat. This enemy success caused a temporary cessation of fire. The two wounded men were cautiously making their way aft to the conning tower, and I called for a couple of stokers to come up and carry away the third, when Von Weissman suddenly gave the order to dive. The gun's crew at once made a rush for the conning tower, and were down the hatch in a trice, one of the wounded men fainting at the bottom. As I was turning to precede him down the conning tower hatch, I distinctly saw the man lying by the gun lift his hand. I felt I could not leave him there, and instinctively cried, "He is still alive!" But Von Weissman, who was urging the crew to hurry down the hatch, pressed the diving alarm as soon as the last sailor was half in the hatch. I knew that this meant that the boat would be under in 30 to 40 seconds, so I had no alternative but to get down the hatch as quickly as possible. I was followed by von Weissman, who joined me in the upper conning tower. I forced myself not to look out of the conning tower scuttles during the few seconds that elapsed as the casing slowly went under, until at last nothing but waving green water showed at each little window. Perhaps von Weissman read my thoughts, or else he remembered my remark concerning the man, for he turned to me, and in level tone said, "Have you any doubt that he was dead?" I hesitated a moment, and he continued, "By my direction you have no doubt. He was. To me a life is a life. The seamen are numbered in their tens of thousands, the U-boats in their tens. The steamer had hit us once, luckily only in the casing. A second hit might well have punctured the pressure hull, and our fate in these waters would have been certain. Once below water, von Weissman seemed more himself. He is never really happy on the surface, at least when in action. He is a true water mole." At 10 a.m. this morning we sighted the topsails of a sailing boat to the southwest. Closing her on the surface, we approached to within about 6,000 meters, when suddenly von Weissman ordered, "Gun action stations." The gun crew came tumbling up, but not quick enough to suit him, for as they were mustering at the gun he gave the order to dive, taking her down to periscope depth, before ordering surface, and then gun action stations. Again. This time we opened fire on the ship, a Norwegian bark, and being in the barred zone, liable to destruction. Von Weissman had announced overnight that at the first opportunity he would give that gun's crew a bellyful of practice, and he did. As soon as the first shot was fired, she backed her topsails, and when our fourth shot struck her, somewhere near the foot of the foremast, her crew could be seen abandoning their ship. This action on their part had no influence with von Weissman, who had taken personal charge of the helm, and, with the engines running at three-quarter speed, he was zigzagging about, to make it harder for the gun's crew. Every now and then, he flung a jibe at the crew, such as suggesting that they should go back to the high seas fleet and learn how to shoot. The sailing ship was soon on fire. Considering the circumstances, the shooting was very fair. When she was blazing nicely fore and aft, von Weissman ordered the practice to cease, and sent the crew below. He ordered course south, speed 10 knots, and I took the watch. An hour and a half later, when the navigator gave me a spell, a black cloud on the northern horizon marked the funeral pyre of another of our victims. When I went below, the captain had just finished playing with his precious old chart. We received a message at 2 a.m. last night from Heligoland to return. It is 2 a.m., and we are approaching the Dover Barrage. We had no trouble coming up channel today, which seems singularly empty, at any rate in mid-channel, where we were. We got back about 3 hours ago, and as I was appointed temporary to the boat, von Weissman allowed me to leave her and come up to Bruges as soon as we got into the shelters at Zeebrugge. I got up here just in time for a late dinner. Hunger satisfied, I retired to my room and rang up my Zoe. She was in, but I heard that accursed swine of a colonel was also back from the front and expected in at the flat at any moment, being then engaged in his after-dinner drinking bouts at the cavalry officers' club. A laugh at the other end stung me, appeased in an instant as she told me I should be glad to hear he was up from the Somme on a 4 days' leave, and was returning next morning by the 8 a.m. troop train. Glad? I could have danced for joy. I breathed again. He goes tomorrow, so far so good, but what of the intervening period? I would give anything to destroy this man, and could shake the Englishman by the hand who fires the delivering bullet. Steady. Steady. What do I write? No. I mean it, every word of it. Yet of all the mysteries, and to me Zoe is a mass of them, surely the strangest of all is contained in the question. Why does she live with him? She doesn't love him, she's practically told me so. In fact, I know she doesn't. Let me reason it out by logic. She lives with him, whether voluntarily or involuntarily. Suppose it be voluntarily, then her reasons must be love, fascination, or some secret reason. If she is living with him involuntarily, it must be. He has a hold on her, for financial reasons. But what hold can he have on her? She can't have a past. She is too young and sweet for that. I must find out about this before I go to sea again. The colonel left as she said he would, and I went round to lunch with her. We had a delightful tete-a-tete, and after lunch she played the piano. Carl, I have an idea. I shall make a prisoner of you for 2 or 3 days. No. I am not joking, I mean it. In a forest not far from Bruges, he had a little summer house, to which she used to retreat for weekends in the hot weather, when the colonel was away. He knew nothing of this country house. She was very insistent on that point, so I imagine she paid for it out of her dress allowance, or in some other way. I was due for 4 days overseas leave, limited to Belgian territory, so this fitted in very well, and I told her so. You mustn't think it's not going to be conventional. Old Babette will be with us to chaperon me. Old Babette is an aged female whom she calls her maid. I think she is jealous of me. I agreed at once that of course I quite understood it was to be highly conventional, though I smiled to myself as I visualized my mother's shocked face and uplifted hands had she heard my Zoe's ideas on the conventions. Of course, as my prisoner you will have to obey all my orders. I replied that this was certainly so. And one of the first things, she continued, that happens to a prisoner is that he is blindfolded. Don't you trust me? In a moment my passion flared up and rained hot kisses on her face as she struggled to release herself from my arms. It was arranged that I should be at her flat with my suitcase at 6 p.m. the next evening, prepared to disappear with me for 48 hours. As he had told me of an address in Bruges which she said would forward on any telegram if I was recalled, and I had to be satisfied with that, for I never discovered where I went to, and I don't know in what part of Belgium I spent the last 2 nights. Zoe was excited, and the flat was in a turmoil, as apparently as he had only just begun to pack her dressing case. Soon after 6 we went down, and got into a large Mercedes car which I had noticed standing outside when I arrived. We were soon on our way, and left Bruges by the eastern barrier. We showed our passes and proceeded into the darkened countryside. We had been running for about a mile when she remarked, "Prisoners will now be blindfolded," and to my astonishment, slipped a little black silk bag over my head. I was so startled I didn't know whether to be angry or to laugh. I did nothing, and, entering into the spirit of the game, declared that even a prisoner had the right not to be stifled, whereupon she lifted the lower portion of the bag and uncovered my mouth. Shortly afterwards, I was electrified to feel a pair of soft lips meet mine. This pleasant journey had lasted for about 3/4 of an hour, when my mask was removed, and I was informed that I was inside the enemy lines. Through the windows of the car I could see an endless mass of fir trees rushing past on each side. This continued for 1 kilometer, when we branched to the right, and entered a large clearing, at one side of which stood the house. Babette, Zoe and myself entered the building, the car disappeared back to Bruges. The house, built of logs, was of 2 stories. On the ground floor were 2 living rooms, and the domains of Babette, who turned out to be a first-class cook. On the 2nd story there were 2 large rooms. The whole house was furnished after the manner of a hunting lodge, with stags' heads on the walls, and skins on the floors. In the drawing room there was a piano, and a few etchings of the wild boar by Chaffain. I dressed for dinner in my smoking jacket. I was glad I did, for she appeared in full evening tenue. She wore a violet gown, and across her forehead a black satin bandeau with a Z in diamonds upon it. We look at so many aspects of the world through the same pair of eyes. When I have been talking to her for a period, I leave her presence feeling completed. A gap within my being has been filled, that a spiritual hunger has been satisfied, that I have got something which I wanted, but for which I could not have formulated the desire in words. When she kissed me goodnight with the tenderness of a mother, and left me to smoke a final cigar, I had said nothing, and I could only wonder at the strange fate that had placed me practically alone with a girl whom I had grown to love with a deep emotion, and who appeared to love me, yet often behaved as if I was her brother. The next day we were like two children. The snow was deep on the ground, and the fir trees stood like thousands of sentinels in gray uniform round the clearing. Once during the afternoon, as with Zoe's assistance I was furiously chopping wood for the fire, a droning noise made me look up, and thousands of meters overhead a small squadron of aeroplanes, bound for the western front, sailed slowly across the sky. I thought how awkward it would be for them if they experienced an engine failure while over the forest, though they were up so high that I imagined they could have glided 10 kilometers, and as I think, but I am not certain, and I have pledged myself not to try and find out, we were in the forest of Montalun, which is barely 15 kilometers broad. I suppose they could have fallen clear of the trees. As a matter of fact, I imagine they would have used our clearing. I'm glad they didn't. That night after dinner she played to me, first Beethoven and then Chopin. I can see her as I write, as he had just finished the 14th prelude, and, resting her chin on her hand, she smiled mysteriously at me. The hour had come, and driven by strong impulses, I spoke. I told her that I loved her as I had never thought that a man could love a woman. I told her that I longed to shield her and protect her, and above all things, to remove her from the clutches of that bestial colonel, and as I bent over her, and felt my senses swim in the subtleties of her perfume, I begged her passionately to say the word that would give me the right to fight the world on her behalf. When I had finished she was silent for a long while, and I can remember distinctly that I wondered whether she could hear the thump, thump, thump of my heart, which to my agitated mind seemed to beat with the strength of a hammer. At length she spoke. Two words came slowly from her lips. I cannot. I was not discouraged. I could see, I could feel, that a tremendous struggle was raging, the outward signs of which were concealed by her averted head. At length I asked her point blank whether she loved me. Her silence gave me my answer, and I took her unresisting body into my arms, and kissed her to distraction. Oh! These kisses, how bitter they seem to me now, and yet how I long to hold her once again. For, freeing herself from my embrace and speaking almost mechanically, she said, "Carl, I must tell you, I cannot marry you." I pleaded, I prayed, I argued, I demanded. It was in vain. I always came up against the immovable I cannot. And then I crashed over the precipice towards whose edge I had been blindly going. I had said for the 100th time, "But you know you love me," when with a sob she abandoned all reserve, and flinging her arms round my neck, implored me to take her. Then, as I caught my breath, she quickly said, as if frightened that as he had gone too far, "But I cannot marry you." I looked down into those beautiful eyes, and for the first time I understood. I battled for my soul and the purity of our love. Then tearing my sight from those eyes which would lure an archangel to destruction, I was once more master of my body. As my resolution grew, I hated her for doing this thing that had wrecked in an instant the hopes of months, the ideals on which I had begun to build afresh my life. She felt the change, and left me. As she went out by the door she gave me one last look, a look in which love struggled with shame, a look which no man has ever earned the right to receive from any woman. But I was as a statue of marble, dazed by this calamity. As the door closed upon her, I started forward. It was too late. Had she waited another instant, but there, I write of what has happened, and not what might have been. There was a note on the breakfast table, but before I opened it I knew that, save for Babette, I was alone in the house. The note was brief, unaddressed and unsigned. "I am leaving for Bruges at 8:30, when the car was ordered to fetch us back. I go alone. Babette will give you breakfast. The car will return for you at 11:00. I rely on your honor in that you will not observe where you have been. Come to me when you want me. Till then, farewell. I have told Max's secretary that I want to get to sea. To be here in Bruges, and not to see her is more than I can bear. I sail at dawn tomorrow. A frightful noise over the New Year celebrations tonight. Champagne flowing like water in the mess. I feel the year 1917 opens badly for me. Weissman also went to sea again for a short trip in the channel, and has not reported for 5 days. Perhaps he has despised the Dover barrage once too often. If this is so, it is a great loss to the service. He was a man of iron resolution in underwater attack. I feel I cannot go out again without a sign I may not return, and I will not leave her, perhaps forever, with this bitterness between us. At sea in UC-47 again. Alton as surly as ever. We left at dawn this morning, to lay mines off the channel to Harwich Harbor, a nest from which submarines, cruisers and destroyers buzz in, and out like wasps. It will be ticklish work. On the bottom. Our minds are still with us, but so are our lives, which is something. We were approaching the appointed spot at 6 a.m. this morning, when without warning the track of a torpedo was seen streaking towards us about 50 yards on the starboard bow. Before Alton, who was on the bridge with me, could do more than press the diving alarm, the track met our ram. I breathed again, and was then reminded by an oath from Alton, that the boat was diving. We had only been saved by the torpedo running deep under the cutaway part of our bow. We kept hydrophone patrol, twice hearing the motors of the enemy submarine. At the moment we are on the bottom waiting, to come up and charge tonight, and lay our mines at dawn tomorrow. On the bottom in 28 meters and feeling none too comfortable, there are a dozen destroyers overhead. It was pitch black dark when I took over at 4 a.m., and a fresh breeze had raised a lumpy sea, which covered the bridge with spray. We were charging 400 amps on each, with the intention of laying one mine directly there was sufficient light to get a fix from some of the buoys, which the English stick down all over the place here, in the most convenient manner possible. If only one could believe they never shifted them. Alton says it never occurs to an Englishman to do a thing like that, but I'm not so sure. We were proceeding at 5 knots, crashing into the sea, when out of the black of the night I saw a shape close aboard on the port hand. I was astounded to see a large submarine, which must have been British, on an opposite course, not more than 25 meters away. I don't know how it struck the officer in the British boat, but I must give him credit for doing something first, for he fired a very white light straight at me as the two boats passed. It impinged on the hull, and in the flash I caught a photographic glimpse of his conning tower, on which was painted the letter E, followed by two numbers, of which one was a 2 I think, and the other a 9. By this time he was on my port quarter and rapidly disappearing. I managed to get my revolver out, and while with the left hand I pressed the diving alarm, with the right hand I emptied the magazine in his direction. When we were down, Alton refused to believe me. At dawn we poked a periscope up, a flotilla of destroyers was looking for something, us unless I am mistaken, so we bottomed, where we have been ever since. The hydroplane operator keeps up a sing-song of, fast-running propellers are either receding or approaching. The crew are collected round the mine tubes as I write, and are singing, Death for the Fatherland! Glorious fate, this is the end, that we gladly await. Diary of a U-Boat Commander,